The date is July 15th, 1988, and we're watching Die Hard. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Merry Christmas!
Christmas, and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Sergeant Powell to my Detective McLean.
I'm Colin Stewart.
And this week, we round out our Christmas season, our fourth Christmas movie, our Christmas Day special, and we brought back one more special guest for these Christmas movies. Please welcome our friend Jack Bazook. Jack, welcome.
Hello.
We need to get fanfare sound effects for our guests, I think.
Oh, I can add those in. I can have fun with those. Yeah. So Jack was someone that both Colin and I had the pleasure of performing with on stage last year. And we were doing a show around Christmas time, and I would wear my favorite ugly Christmas sweater, which is a diehard Christmas sweater. And Jack was someone that didn't understand it at all. And then I discovered that he's never seen this most classic of Christmas movies. Jack, why the hell not?
I'm young. That's about it. I mean,
that's fair.
There was really no reason. It wasn't on my radar. It wasn't not my family's Christmas movie. Yeah. My mom can't watch anything action. She doesn't like blood or anything, so it's not her thing. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, it just wasn't something I had the opportunity to see.
If you don't mind me asking, what year were you born?
2001.
Okay, so this movie was already like 13 years old.
Yeah, so it's a little out of my vision range there.
So we have asked this of some of our other guests. What is your Christmas movie of choice? Because Die Hard is my Christmas movie of choice, and we have found out that Collins is Home Alone. So for a 2001 baby, man, 2001, that just doesn't sound right. But okay, so for a 2001 baby, what was your Christmas movie growing up?
We had this VHS of Mickey Mouse. Mm-hmm. There was like a Mickey Mouse Christmas special. And I remember watching that like over and over again. There's one, it was Mickey Mouse and like Pluto, and they just like did Christmassy things. I think it might have been like a compilation DVD, like a VHS, it wasn't even a DVD.
I remember that one. It's called Once Upon a Christmas.
And yeah, that's the one.
And then they did
a
sequel, and it was like Twice Upon a Christmas or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Right on.
I guess the one I watched the most.
Okay, well, this week we are looking back at July 1988, when the movies and theaters were Licensed to Drive, a couple of Coreys in that one, Arthur 2 on the Rocks, Phantasm 2, Short Circuit 2, it was the month of sequels there, and of course our movie for today, Die Hard, which earned $140.8 million on a $28 million budget.
And of course, I mean, I feel like these spoiler alerts are getting a little old now.
They gotta be done.
But they must be done just in case. I don't want hate mail or anything like that. So the movie is 32 years old at this point. If you haven't seen it, there will be spoilers. So please press pause, go watch it, and then come back.
So there are many, many different poster taglines out there for this movie. an obscene amount of poster taglines. Things like 40 stories of sheer adventure, 13 terrorists, one cop, the odds are against John McClane, that's just the way he likes it. Or it's Christmas Eve in LA and the party action's about to explode on the 40th floor. Or he's the only chance anyone has got. Or there's mixtures of all of those. So there are several more, but my personal favorite is, it will blow you through the back wall of the theater.
I like that.
Very, very 80s action. But those may not be the best descriptions of this movie, so let's go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
All right, today's 60-second synopsis is brought to you by me and Christmas. Christmas is a magical time of the year, a time for miracles, which is why on Christmas Eve 1988, NYPD cop John McClane arrives in Los Angeles to attend a Christmas party in Nakatomi Plaza and try to win back his estranged wife, Holly. Unfortunately for John, a German crime syndicate led by Professor Snape Hans Gruber have decided to crash the party and take the guests hostage while they work to open a bank vault and steal the money inside. With his wife and her co-workers in danger, it's up to John, along with his sidekicks Argyle and Carl Winslow, to save the day.
So, Colin, we've heard what Jack's experience with Die Hard is before now. What about you? Where does Die Hard fall on the whole pantheon of Christmas movies, or what is your experience? Do you have one?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm considerably older than Jack. I was born in 86, so I was 2 years old when this movie came out. Mm-hmm. But despite that, my mom also is not a fan of big action, violent movies. So I didn't watch this movie probably until, like, the mid-2000s.
That is kind of funny that you say that about your mom, though, because, like, in the last couple months, you have told me that both Lost Boys and Lethal Weapon are two of her favorites.
Yeah, and I hadn't seen those movies, so I didn't realize how violent they were. Okay. But she would always just, like, my mom wouldn't let me play with G.I. Joes.
Oh, okay.
Because she was one of those, like, she didn't want to promote war, violence, and guns and all that stuff. So I watched Die Hard at a time where I was kind of, like, going back. I think I watched Die Hard, all the Rockies, okay, all these movies I'd never seen before, yeah, sometime in the mid-2000s, and that was the last time I'd watched it until now.
Jack, have you ever seen any of the other Die Hard movies?
No.
Oh, okay,
First one, I hadn't seen any of the others.
Well, we had this come up a couple weeks ago when we talked about Lethal Weapon, is that Colin had seen some of the future Lethal Weapons, but not the original. So that's why I was curious about that.
Yeah, no.
What about Bruce Willis? Where does Bruce Willis fall for you? How much of a draw is he? If there's a Bruce Willis movie that comes out, how much of a draw is he for you?
Before watching this one, not very much. I mean, but I feel like if something else new comes out now that I've seen his entrance into stardom, then I probably will check it out just because I see how much of an interesting actor he is to watch.
Yeah.
It's interesting when he's young, right? Because I've seen, like, Fast and Furious.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I've seen him in those ones, but it was interesting to see, like, his what he started with.
He was in Fast and Furious?
Was he not? Am I crazy? Was he not, like, the main actor in Fast and Furious?
That's Vin Diesel. That's Vin Diesel.
Oh, my God! Okay, I'll leave. I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave now, guys. Guys.
Bruce Willis does show up in the odd random thing like G.I.
Joe. Yeah, I was going to say.
He's done some weird things.
I know that Kurt, yeah, I was like, did Bruce Willis, because, like, after Fast Five, when they become, like, military operatives,
and
I was like,
Rock
yeah,
shows like, up did Bruce and Jason Statham and shit.
Like, it's actually even more hilarious that you thought Bruce Willis was Vin Diesel. Like, huge. I don't know who that's a bigger insult to, but but it might just be a draw.
I mean, in Fast and Furious, he looks so young. All right. Well, let's jump into Die Hard. Directed by John McTiernan, who has only 12 director credits, Hunt for Red October, Die Hard with a Vengeance, so the third Die Hard, Last Action Hero, and Rollerball. It was produced by Charles Gordon, who produced Die Hard 2, Field of Dreams, Waterworld, The Rocketeer, Hitman, and Hitman Agent 47. And it's written by Stephen E. D'Souza, who has 43 credits, some of them being Commando, 48 Hours, The Running Man, Street Fighter, Die Hard 2, Beverly Hills Cop 3, and Gotta Catch Santa Claus for another Christmas connection. Also written by Jeb Stuart, who has 14 credits, Leviathan, Lockup, which is a Sylvester Stallone movie, The Fugitive, Fire Down Below, which is a Steven Seagal movie, and, of course, also written by Roderick Thorpe, who wrote the book Nothing Lasts Forever, which is what this movie is based on. And 6 of his 9 credits are Die Hard movies or video games. Not Die Hard 2 for some reason, but he gets the very specific credit of certain characters created by. I've never seen that credit before. Very specific.
Interesting. Do we know which certain characters? Like, I'm assuming John McClane?
No! Oh. Actually, I see, that's the thing, is about 5 years ago, this is a Christmas movie that I watch, like, every Christmas. And 5 years ago was, like, the first time when I realized that it's based on a book. And so I decided to read the book, and the main character is named Leland in that one. And he's much older, like he's a retired cop. And actually, interestingly, in the book, he's going to LA to see his grown daughter, not his estranged wife. And the scene with the Rolex, with Hans falling out of the window, his daughter goes with him. So like they actually kill off the person that he's gone to see in that in the book. Wow. So it's interesting seeing how close it is to Die Hard, but also still so very different. So we open the movie on no music, just like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and the sound of an airplane landing, because we see the airplane. We cut to the inside of the plane, where a visibly stressed John McClane is gripping the armrests of his seat. And John McClane, of course, is played by Bruce Willis. I'm sure everyone knows who he is. But here are a few of the credits you might not immediately associate with. Well, Jack might not. But
what do you mean? Fast and Furious isn't on that list?
But yeah, here's how about Death Becomes Her, Hudson Hawk, North, 12 Monkeys, Four Rooms, one of the only movies where he actually didn't receive a paycheck. He was the voice of Mickey in Look Who's Talking. And, of course, never forget that he's also a singer, where his album The Return of Bruno got all the way up to 14th on the Billboard charts back in 1987 or 86 or whenever it was. And most recently, Bruce Willis appeared in a 2020 commercial called Die Hard is Back. And it's a commercial for, guess what? Die Hard batteries.
What would you say, like, what's Bruce Willis's most famous role outside of Die Hard? Because honestly, I know he was in, like, A Few Good Men or, like, that
No, that was Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson. He was in Armageddon.
Maybe Armageddon
would be one of his next biggest ones. Sixth Sense, Pulp Fiction, Unbreakable. That's tough, because he's kind of in everything.
I really liked this movie I watched in high school that had Mos Def. I think it's called like 16 Blocks, plays like a grizzled cop, and he has to get this prisoner from, I think it's like the jail to the courthouse while all these people are trying to kill him or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for Die Hard, yeah, he might have a very different trajectory in his career. Yeah. And a lot of people forget that he started out, and he was still on when he filmed this movie, Moonlighting. Mm-hmm. So he started off as like kind of a sitcom guy. So on the plane, the seatmate to John tells him that the secret to air travel is that when you get where you're going, take off your shoes and make fists with your toes and walk around on the carpet. Trust me, I've been doing it for 9 years. John gets up to retrieve his luggage from the overhead compartment when the seatmate spots his gun. It's okay, I'm a cop. Trust me, I've been doing it for 11 years.
I get he's a cop, but are cops just allowed to take their gun everywhere?
That's what I was wondering. Like, even in 1988, are you allowed to carry on a flight? Like, I know they're allowed to take their guns, but I think they have to be in, like, a secure box in their luggage or something like that. Like, just having a shoulder holster.
I always feel sometimes like there's this internal movie logic that just allows, like, if you're just a cop in America, you're a cop everywhere in America, even though that's not really how it works at all.
No. Well, it works when it benefits people, but you do hear this isn't your jurisdiction a lot until it, like, plays into the other cop's favors. Without that dynamic of the jurisdiction and being a cop everywhere, you wouldn't have movies like Beverly Hills Cop, so.
Yeah.
We are now shown a Christmas party in progress at the Nakatomi building with pretentious violin music playing. Maybe I'm not living a fancy enough life, but why do movie parties always have violins playing? And it's a Christmas party. Like, where are the carols?
Well, yeah.
Like, the violins could have at least been playing, like, Silent Night or some shit.
I mean, I find it odd, and again, I get it's your favorite Christmas movie, but I feel like at some point we need to have a discussion about why this is a Christmas movie. I get that Christmas is... It's a weird choice to me that Christmas is even happening, considering that the movie came out in July.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know that if I went into a movie theater in July and I walked in and all of a sudden the premise of the movie was set around Christmas, I think I'd find it a little bit odd.
That's true, and it would have been the same for Lethal Weapon, because that one wasn't released around Christmas either. That was a July release, if I remember correctly, too.
It's also weird because it's just set at Christmas. Like, they're having a Christmas party. It's not like it's Christmas Eve. It's not like it's anything really to do with Christmas other than the fact that it's around that time. Like, they're not like, it's just interesting, like, because that's about it, right? It's just like at Christmas. and they're like Christmas music playing sometimes in the background of the score. And right? There's really nothing else to do with Christmas. It's not snowing because they're in California. Yeah. It's not.
I was gonna say
why is it Christmas?
Yeah, I was gonna say similarly to Lethal Weapon, which also takes place in California. Mm-hmm. It's like if you wanted to have a Christmas, why wouldn't you just do it in New York where it actually snows and you could actually have Christmas?
Yeah,
exactly.
It's like because it's in California, you constantly have to do stuff to really show us it's Christmas. Like he has to write ho ho ho, I have the machine gun now. In Lethal Weapon, it's just constantly like, oh, here's your
have some eggnog.
Here's your like 15-minute reminder that it's Christmas time right now.
Well, I will say that an argument could be made that if it wasn't set at Christmas, this whole movie doesn't work because they have to have a skeletal group of employees in this building in order to pull off this heist properly, right? So there is that.
Interesting.
Oh, wow.
So at this party, Mr. Takagi gives a speech congratulating everyone on a successful year. He's played by James Shigeta, who has 89 credits, a lot of TV, and all the way back to 1959 in a movie called The Crimson Kimono. We then see Holly Gennaro McLean, who is played by Bonnie Bedelia, Amelia Bedelia's sister.
Who's that?
You never read what? Amelia Bedelia?
Amelia,
oh, wow.
Bedelia? What
like
is this?
The kid from 2001 that understands that reference in those books.
I know Amelia Bedelia.
Yeah.
Is this like a kid's book?
Yeah. It was, yeah. It's like Ramona age book.
I don't know
Ramona? Superfudge? Do you know Superfudge? Oh, okay.
No, I don't know any of these references.
Okay.
Oh, man. I'm getting them all.
I know Robert Munch.
There
and
you go.
Goosebumps.
Well, okay. Goosebumps age.
Okay.
Bonnie Bedelia has 90 credits. Die Hard 2, Die Harder, Needful Things, 88 episodes of a show called The Division. She's headed to her office and being followed and gently sexually harassed by Ellis, who is played by Hart Bochner, who has 54 credits. A lot of uncredited, quote, unquote, 10 episodes of The Starter Wife in 2008, and most recently 4 episodes of a show called Too Old to Die Young. Ellis basically is a scumbag. Nice broad strokes to introduce Ellis. We learn who he is fairly quickly. Holly tells her assistant, who is working late, to go enjoy the party and have some champagne. Her very pregnant assistant, who says, "You think the baby can handle a sip?" And Holly says, "That baby is ready to 10 bar. Ah, 1988.
I, like, was fetal alcohol syndrome not a thing in the 1980s?
Even as a kid, this line used to make me cringe. Like, it's just not right. Holly calls home. McLean residence, Lucy McLean speaking, to tell her housekeeper Paulina to make up the spare room because there's a possibility Mr. McLean might be coming home. I already did, Mrs. Holly. But then, for some reason, puts the family picture on the credenza face down. Obviously, this comes into play later, but I've never understood the motivation of why she flips down. She seems excited that her husband might be coming to stay. Why does she want to flip down the reminder of her husband all of a sudden?
Because it's a physical manifestation of her showing that she doesn't want to get her hopes up.
Hopes up. Okay, that maybe makes a little sense. Yeah.
That's just my like pretentious acting choice assumption.
Okay. It's a physical manifestation of her hopes not getting up.
I'll take it. So back to John in the airport smoking. More 1988. He's watching people greeting each other and muttering under his breath, "California," when he comes upon a limo driver holding a sign with the name McLean on it. "Hey, I'm John McLean." "Well, I'm Argyle." "Okay, Argyle, what do we do now? I was hoping you'd tell me. It's my first night." Argyle is kind of a fun little sidekick character to have. Argyle, of course, is played by Devereaux White, who has 33 credits, Action Jackson, 47 episodes of Head of the Class, which was an 80s sitcom, Blues Brothers, and in 2014 played an Uber driver in the show Workaholics. So, you know, I guess typecasting maybe. and he reprised his role of Argyle in that Die Hard is Back commercial. I watched the commercial. I'm going to post it on our social media because it's 2 minutes of pure awesome. Like, it's got Ode to Joy playing. It's John McClane can't start his car, so he has to go buy a new battery instead of like getting a jump. But like all the terrorists like attack him. So John sits up front in the limo while Argyle is pointing out all the highlights of the limo. 1988, it has CB, CD, VHS. Argyle is chatting him up because he used to be a cab driver where people expect some chit chat. We get some brief explanation about why John is still in New York with his wife in LA. She had a good job that turned into a great career, and Argyle observes, "You thought she'd fail." And John says, like I said, you're very astute, Argyle.
That was one thing that didn't really make sense to me. Like, it seems like they're recently kind of split up.
Mm-hmm.
But the story would lead me to believe that, like, it's been a lot. It's been a while.
Well, he did say to Argyle that he had, like, 6 months worth of back cases to work on. So yeah. I'd say that it's been at least 6 months. And, you know, with the type of character that John is, it feels almost like it's been 6 months. And then, well, I still haven't quite closed all of them. So 6 months turned into 8 or 9. I'd say it's between 6 months and a year that they've been separated. So Argyle puts in some music, and John says, don't you have any Christmas music? This is Christmas music, and it's specifically Christmas in Hollis by Run DMC. They pull up to Nakatomi Plaza, and Argyle turns out to be an above and beyond good guy when he offers to wait in the parkade. If you score, call me on the car phone, and I'll take your bags to the front desk, strike out, and I'll take you somewhere you need to stay. Just remember how good I am when you sign for the tip. At the security desk, we get one of the most pointless scenes in this film. This scene is like the dumbest scene. It's just filler for some reason. It seems like the only purpose is to show that Nakatomi Plaza has some high-tech technology, like this touchscreen computer, and that Holly is now going by the last name Gennaro. Like, that seems like that's the only point of the scene. Because he asks where Holly McLean is, the security guard tells him to just punch it into the computer, and when he says, it says 30th floor, the security guard informs him, yeah, they're the only ones left in the building. Shouldn't you have been able to walk in and say, do you know where Holly McLean is? Well, if she isn't on the third floor where everybody's partying, she's not here. So he takes the express elevator and gets off when he hears the noise. The party is in full swing. Some random guy kisses John and John has says, Jesus, fucking California. He meets Mr. Takagi, who is the one responsible for the limo John arrived in. I appreciate that this movie goes a little against the usual character stereotypes that we see in a lot of these movies. Like, it's first shown here with an Asian character without an accent. Like, out of all the movies we've watched, this is the first time that we have an Asian character that's not pouring on an accent. He's a well-spoken businessman. Yay, diversity! You know, and also, like, when Theo shows up, like, he's the nerd, and it's like, okay, good job, 1988. Make the black guy the nerd instead of, like, you know, like, just like go against the usual casting types for this. And
it's also true when, like, the two FBI agents show up,
Johnson and Johnson,
like, the black guy is, he's like the straight man, and the white guy is kind of like, he's the one who's like a little bit off.
Yeah, that relationship would usually be like the little Johnson, as he's called, would have been like Chris Tucker or or Kevin Hart or something. Takagi gives us a few more broad strokes of setup when John McClane tells him that it's a nice place he got here. And, well, it will be. There's still several floors under construction.
Foreshadowing.
John is delivered to Holly's office, where Ellis is doing coke off her desk, and Takagi introduces Ellis to Holly's policeman husband, to which John, when he meets Ellis, says, miss some, under his nose. Holly comes in, and we get an awkward reunion with a weird music change. Did you notice that the music...
No, I didn't.
It's just like, it all of a sudden becomes like this dramatic, like, love story type music. It just comes out of nowhere. It's very strange. Ellis brags about how they're celebrating not only Christmas, but a big business deal too. We get a quick scene, seeing a truck driving down the street. And then we're back to John and Holly, where John is cleaning up in Holly's bathroom. How disgusting does he feel after a 6-hour flight that he needs to, like, strip down to wash up in a private bathroom? He's like using a washcloth to, like, clean his pits and everything like that. It was a 6-hour flight. You weren't on the plane for 15 hours.
I mean, they had to get him into the tank top somehow, right?
That's true.
Yeah. The only thing they're missing was having him, like, dry off with paper towel. I mean, not paper towel, with, like, newspaper.
So John and Holly are discussing John's plans while he's in town, something you can tell she's probably been rehearsing in a mirror, how to make this dance that she's doing seem casual. John is planning on crashing with an old buddy in Pomona. You'll spend all your time driving. Why don't we make it easy? I have a spare bedroom. She tenderly tells him, I missed you. And John fucks it up by saying, I guess you didn't miss my name. She passes it off as working for a Japanese company where they don't respond well to married women. Here's the question, though. What about the name McLean says that she's married? Just change the Mrs. to Miss. And Yahtzee, you look unmarried. You know, like, she could just go by Ms. McLean.
Yeah.
Take off the ring and go by Ms. McLean. So cut back to the mysterious truck we saw a few minutes ago, which is now pulling up to the Nakatomi building with a Mercedes pulling right in front of it. It always looks like he's cutting him off for some reason. The truck heads down into the parking garage and the Mercedes to the front door. The men from the car walk into the lobby as one of them is giving the play-by-play of a basketball game as a distraction. Then boom! Security guard takes a silencer shot to the face. The shooter is Carl, played by Alexander Gudinov, who only has 10 credits. He appeared in Witness, Money Pit, North with Bruce Willis. But his first three credits are actually in Bolshoi ballet movies, because he's actually a trained ballet dancer. And he was classmates with Mikhail Baryshnikov. So, Jack, I know that you're a dancer. Do you know the name Alexander Gudinov?
I did not until I found out that he was a ballet dancer. And you can see it in his stunt acting. You can see it in his, like, fighting.
Yeah.
He looks like he can jump really high.
I could believe that.
Like that's sort of the ballet dancer appeal. Those guys can jump insanely high.
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't know a lot of ballet dancers, but to know that he was a classmate with Baryshnikov, like,
yeah, that's,
Baryshnikov
that's...
is one that I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
As I say, Baryshnikov's probably the only ballet dancer that I know by name.
Yeah, well, Carol Kane? No, not Carol Kane. Carol, okay, no. Yep, that's the only one I know. Yeah, so Carl is the shooter, and the distractor is Theo, who is played by Clarence Gilliard Jr. He's a Christmas Eve baby. He was in Top Gun, Karate Kid 2, Walker, Texas Ranger, like all of Walker, Texas Ranger.
Oh, yeah, he's his partner.
Plus the movies. Yeah. Nice. He was in Left Behind 1 and 2, and he was also in Die Hard is Back, that commercial. They use a hockey puck-sized flashbang to distract the other security guard and shoot him dead. Meanwhile, in the parking garage, the truck is pulled up to the loading dock, unnoticed by Argyle. The back opens, and out come the rest of the bad guys out of the empty truck, I'll point out.
I noticed that. I caught that. I was so confused later.
That's impressive that you caught that on your first viewing of this film, because it was probably a good 12 viewings before I actually went, wait a minute, that's not
in my
right.
head. I went, were they standing in front of the van? Like, where did the van come from? And when did the truck get moved away from the loading dock?
So good on you, Jack.
Wow. Yeah. I only knew that because I watched a YouTube video once that went through, like, weird mistakes in movies stuff like that.
The gang of thugs are led by their leader, Hans Gruber, the late, great Alan Rickman, who has 70 credits, Quigley Down Under, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Galaxy Quest, Dogma, Blow Dry, which is one that I slip in there because that's probably one that no one has ever seen except me, where he plays a hairdresser. It's a fun little independent movie. And of course, he's Professor Severus Snape in the Harry Potter franchise. Theo is the nerd of the operation. He takes over the computers to lock down the building before smashing them. The gang members come up to the lobby in the elevator. Hans strides over to the door with urgent purpose and then pauses with the key card over the lock, takes a super dramatic look around that seems to stretch out forever, and then swipes the card to lock them in. Building hijacked. Meanwhile, Tony the thug is urgently walking around back hallways looking for the phone lines, comes to some stairs and slides down on his armpits, probably just because it looks cool. While all this is going on, up on the 30th floor, John has taken off his socks and shoes and clearly doesn't know what the definition of a fist is, because he's doing more of a, like, stroking, wiggling thing rather than walking around with the fists like the man on the plane suggested. Unless he just finished walking around and he's just doing his final stretch. But, you know, son of a bitch, fist with your toes.
He needs to just watch some, like, Bruce Lee movies or something like that. Train the feet.
He decides to phone Argyle to keep him in the loop. We watch as Tony the Terrorist. Tony, I just realized that's very close to Tony the Tiger. We watch as Tony the Terrorist is carefully splicing and cutting wires, but Carl shows up with a chainsaw to make it go faster. And in a tense moment, he manages to make the last couple splices before Carl finishes chainsawing. And I've never quite understood the stakes here. What is he splicing, and how much does it matter if the lines are just being cut anyway? Like, was he bypassing a silent alarm or something? Like, that's what I have to assume.
Yeah, you'd think so.
But then everything just gets cut anyway, so where was he splicing from? Like, I've never understood that moment, but I guess it looks fancy. It looks like they're doing something. Well, John, who was on the phone with Argyle, suddenly has the line go dead on him. And Argyle says, "You know the number, use it." The terrorists have now arrived on the 30th floor, fire off their machine guns, everyone screams, and they set out on roundup duty. And John reacts, he grabs his gun, he peeps out the crack in the door, and realizes he's outnumbered and outgunned. And when the bad guys are coming down the hallway, and they have to break up two people hooking up in an office, they are distracted by tits long enough for John to get across the hallway barefoot into the stairwell. As he climbs up the stairs, he pauses to peek out of the door on other levels just to find more bad guys, until he finally gets up to one of the aforementioned under-construction levels, which is a bad guy-free zone, and finds that all the phone lines are dead there, too. Meanwhile, on the 30th floor, Hans has gotten right to business looking for Joseph Yoshimoba Takagi, whom he happens to know just about everything about, except for what he looked like. So this shows you how hard it was to be a terrorist back in 1988. You couldn't just Google what Mr. Takagi looked like. So Holly holds him back at first, but eventually Mr. Takagi, "It's enough." But I love how quickly Hans's demeanor changes here, you know, to the "How do you do?" Alan Rickman is a fantastic bad guy.
I mean, I don't think he was at his prime in this movie, because, I mean, I don't understand why they didn't just let him be British.
Yeah.
Made him German.
Like, German in quotation marks. It's,
yeah.
It's all over the place.
Yeah. Well, and you're right, considering the fact that not everyone is German. Like, even if you factor in some of the bad accents, not everyone is German anyway, because I don't think Al Leong is playing a German guy.
No.
I don't think Theo is supposed to be German.
Well, the ballet guy, clearly his name sounds Russian.
He is Russian,
They could have went with Russian.
Yeah. It just, they're clearly, like, international thieves, and it's not like the German actually plays into anything in the movie anyway. Like, that's a very good point. John is being a good detective, taking stock of the floors to see what he has at his disposal. We see that the bad guys have guided missiles as well. Hans has Takagi in the elevator, taking him up a floor to his office, humming Ode to Joy and complimenting his suit he has to himself. I decided to start an Ode to Joy tally, and it gets used 4 different times in this movie. Interestingly, the composer, Michael Kamen, thought it was sacrilege to use Beethoven in an action movie and refused to blend it into his score. And then the director ended up convincing him, because the same song is used in A Clockwork Orange as the theme for the Ultraviolence. And Michael Kamen is a big Stanley Kubrick fan, and so he agreed to use it. Takagi is escorted into his own office because Theo has some questions for him. They want passcodes that Takagi insists he doesn't have, and that they'll be changed in the morning anyway. Whatever terroristing they have planned is pointless. Hans replies with, "I'm interested in the $640 million in negotiable bearer bonds in the safe downstairs." "You want money? What kind of terrorists are you? Who said we were terrorists?" I also love the little exchange going on in the background between Theo and Carl, where he's not going to tell, but Carl insists that it's not over yet. And then, like, when they actually shoot Takagi, Carl pays up. Mm. They had a side bet going on. Hans is going to count to 3. There won't be a 4. It really is a nice suit. It would be a shame to ruin it, as he unscrews the silencer. "And you're just going to have to kill me." Okay, bang. Takagi brains all over the window. And it's funny, because from what I read is they tried as many times as possible to not show Alan Rickman shooting in this movie, because he would flinch.
like he would get scared.
Like he would flinch. Yeah, he would flinch at the noise. They try to cut away from his face as often as possible when he's firing a gun.
I wonder if there's like a blooper reel of him just taking shots and be like, "Ah!" like dropping the gun, was like, "Oh,
that's louder than I expected." John has witnessed the murder while hiding in the outer office. Carl hears him, but when he pursues, loses him and concludes he must have heard things. Hans clarifies that Theo can break the code. "You didn't bring me along for my charming personality." Theo has some of the worst lines in the movie. We see bad guys setting up C4, and we get to see the vault that they were trying to get at, with some subtle cello playing Ode to Joy here. Back on one of his hideaway construction floors, John is talking to himself. Why didn't you stop them, John? Because then you'd be dead too, asshole. And Argyle, please tell me you heard those shots. Isn't he a cop? Like, shouldn't he know there's no way whatsoever that sound can be heard 35 stories away?
He's just an NYPD street cop. They don't pay him to know stuff.
Or he's just really, really optimistic. But just to make sure that there's no question about him hearing, we get treated to a quick glimpse of Argyle sitting in the back of his limo on the phone with music bumping. So while John is busy telling himself to think, damn it, think, he gets a Jimmy Neutron brain blast to set off the fire alarm. So the bad guys catch on and use the building code to call off the fire trucks. But wait, ponders Hans, which floor was the fire reported on? Tony, in his ugly gray sweatsuit that is oddly tight in weird places, is sent to investigate. John watches as the fire trucks turn back when the elevator dings and all the lights get turned on by Tony. He gets a bit of cat and mouse scene with John setting off a power saw to misdirect him, and John gets the jump on him. There are rules for policemen. A fight breaks out between them. Bruce Willis's stuntman taking some great hits, and they end up tumbling down a set of stairs. Bruce Willis's stuntman is terrible. Like, he does not look enough like Bruce Willis to.
Well, they fooled me. I didn't notice.
I didn't notice.
All of the big falls, I just think are so, like, unless they are, but I just think that all the big falls just don't look like him at all. But they end up tumbling down a set of stairs, and Tony is dead from a broken neck. And like a video game death, McLean has now leveled up and acquired a machine gun, extra clips of ammo, a walkie-talkie, and a Zippo lighter. I don't understand, though, when he takes the lighter from the guy, like, he gives this weird, suspicious look around, like, you know, did anyone see me take this?
just taking the lighter, not killing the guy. That part's fine, but
yeah, you know. Like it's not regular looking around for a bad guy. Like it really looks like, is anyone watching? it just doesn't feel like the right kind of look on his face. But he doesn't get shoes because, unfortunately, out of all the terrorists he could have killed, he found the one with feet smaller than his sister. And he ties the dead body to a chair and, with a mischievous smirk at Christmas decorations, gets an idea. He sends the guy down in the elevator wearing a Santa hat and with a message written on his shirt that says, "Now I have a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho." The bad guys are discussing what to do about the problem of a renegade do-gooder. The whole while, John is hiding on top of the elevator, taking notes on his arm with a Sharpie. They need to tell Carl because Tony was his brother. So the elevator John is on gets called up to the top floor where Carl is. John takes his opportunity to get off at the roof. And then we get the funny sight gag of a picture of a naked woman that distracts John McClane as he walks by. Down on the 30th, Carl is losing his fucking shit. He wants revenge. But Hans refuses to alter the plan, even with a rogue Boy Scout. Holly secretly knows it's John causing the trouble because he has a way of pissing people off. Or how about because you haven't seen him since the terrorists took you hostage and he's a trained cop?
Yeah.
Shouldn't that be the reason? Holly. John is up on the roof using his stolen walkie-talkie to mayday a 911 on an emergency channel, which pisses off the 911 dispatcher. This channel is for emergency use only. No fucking shit, lady. Does it sound like I'm ordering a pizza? This is an FCC violation. Fine, send someone down here to arrest me. So they reluctantly decide to send a black and white by to check because it's the same building that had a fire alarm earlier. The bad guys, of course, have overheard the radio call and realize the roof is the only place he'd be able to transmit from. They send a small team up to the roof to find him, but no one gets to kill him but Carl. Take that, John. Carl is coming for you. Cut to inside a convenience store where we meet Sergeant Al Powell, who is Reginald Val Johnson, who reprises the role in Die Hard 2, and he does voice work in Die Hard video games, one called Nakatomi Plaza and one called Vendetta. And he's in a Christmas episode of the show Chuck, where he also plays Al Powell.
Really?
Yep. But really, this is Carl Winslow from Family Matters. And and he also has a hilarious guest appearance in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I don't know if either of you are Brooklyn Nine-Nine watchers. But yeah.
Which episode? I don't remember seeing him.
He gets to be part of Jake's bachelor party.
Oh my god!
The bachelor party that Charles sets up for the
big giant
hunt.
Long. It's a million. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. The Reginald Val Johnson was in supposed there? To be part of it because Die Hard is Jake's
favorite
movie.
Right. Oh my god! I remember now. I remember now. Oh my goodness! Because that's so neat.
This guy Reginald, he is a victim of typecasting, in my opinion. He must be like he must have played a cop at least five different named police officers in his career.
Oh, at least, yeah. And he's the stereotypical fat cop is what he is. Like, he's not exactly a svelte cop, you know?
Like, when you get introduced to him in Die Hard, he's literally about to give himself diabetes.
That's right.
He's buying, like, 8 Twinkies.
Yeah, so Al Powell is busy buying Twinkies. The clerk is razzing him, saying, I thought you guys only ate donuts. And Al tries to say they're for his wife, and the clerk doesn't buy it. She's pregnant, he says, and he's still skeptical. Bag it. But I think it's time to talk about those Twinkies a bit in Sponsorship Corner! So, always looking for product placements in movies, this week, Die Hard is brought to you by Hostess Twinkies and other Hostess Cakes. I think this is at least our dozenth mention of Hostess Twinkies. It's gotta be.
Yeah, Twinkies seem like they were the snack food of the 80s.
Yeah.
I honestly don't think I've ever eaten one.
I have, don't
you? I offered you a Twinkie Wiener sandwich and you didn't have a Twinkie.
Yeah, no. Twinkies and Wieners? No, thank you.
Oldsmobile, Mercedes and Ford, Rolex, a blurry McDonald's, Pacific Courier, which is the truck that they're driving to the parkade, which amusingly makes an appearance in another huge action movie, Speed. The plane that the bus crashes into at the end and everything explodes is also a Pacific Courier plane in that movie. Evian Water, Pacific Bell Telephone, John Phillips of London, rumor has it Arafat buys his suits there, Fritos and Doritos, Tic Tacs. my autocorrect changed that to Tic Taco. Coca-Cola, Big Red, Juicy Fruit, and Double Mint Gum, Mars, Crunchy, and Hershey's Chocolate Bars, Planters Peanuts, and Motorola. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. So Al is the closest to the disturbance at Nakatomi Plaza and is dispatched code 2, which means no siren or lights, by the way. It's an actual LAPD code. Up on the roof, we get some gunplay between John and a couple of the bad guys while Carl is walking slowly across the roof to try to get the drop on him. John manages to give him the slip, gets through a fan using the gun as a versatile tool. Like, this is like really like Swiss Army gun. Right? Pauses to acknowledge the titty picture, ladies. His elevator is gone, so he has to find a new way down, breaks the screen out of a vent with his versatile weapon again, then uses his Swiss Army gun again to prop in the opening and the strap to climb down the vent, and he doesn't have quite enough rope to make it to the opening of the vent below him. He has to jump, and he almost misses, which is actually a blooper, because the stunt guy fucked up and actually missed catching the vent, so they kind of wrote it into, like, him missing the first one and catching the second one. Nice. They changed
really?
It.
Really? Yeah. That's so neat.
Carl hears him, goes to investigate. John in the vent lights his lighter to get an idea of his surroundings. Come to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
That lighter is very bright.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like he flicks on the lighter and it's like he's got like a ring light on his face. Like, the lighter is really bright light for that little opening.
Well, yeah, but it is a very dark vent. I mean, there's no light source from the other end of it already.
It's also very close to his face. Yeah. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I've had, like, even, like, small Bic lighters.
Yeah.
And when they're even remotely close to you, it hurts.
Yeah. Carl sees the light and races downstairs to try to find the vent he's in. And, of course, as he crawls through the vent, John also gets the line of, now I know what a TV dinner feels like. Carl has found where the vents are, shoots the vent, and then starts poking the vent with the muzzle of the gun. John, in a tense moment, quietly cocks his gun and aims to kill. Carl and the other guy get called away on the radio. So, phew, lucky timing. John gets out of the vents, and he is so dirty now. And, like, aren't those brand new vents? Like, why is he so dirty?
I was going to comment on this. He comes out of the vent, and he's wearing a black tank top. Well, like, he went from white to black in the course of that shiny, clean vent.
Through the shiny vent. So now he's back in Takagi's office, where the body has been removed, but the carpet is still stained with blood. He watches as Al pulls up to the front of the building. Who's driving, Stevie Wonder? Like, McClane is so convinced that everything going on inside should be so obvious from the street. It's like hoping that Argyle heard the gunfire, like, all over again, is that he's kind of like, why don't you see me up here?
Yeah, like, I'm also assuming this tower is in the middle of downtown Los Angeles area.
Yep.
And I don't know, I've been to LA, and I feel like it's a pretty big, sprawling, loud city. You probably wouldn't hear anything from the outside ever.
Yeah, because they're downtown.
Except for the explosions later, you'd probably see that. But
yeah, LA's downtown is also a little more spread out than most other downtowns, because they don't really have a centralized downtown. Yeah. You're 30 floors up, you're expecting the cop to see you. I don't know. Al approaches the door. The fake security guard at the front lets him in to look around while he watches football. Ah, shit, I got $50 on them assholes. Really good job putting on an American accent. He brings in the southern accent, even though, like, his German accent wasn't very strong to begin with. John finally realizes he has to figure out a way to get the cop's attention, so he starts trying to smash out the window. His attempt is interrupted by two bad guys who have somehow seen this from a lower level. And they ambush him. He easily kills one of them and crawls away under a long conference table as the second guy walks on the table, shooting down through the table at him. Says, next time, don't hesitate. And McClane shoots at him through the table, saying, thanks for the advice. But I don't actually know how these are fatal shots. Like, all the wounds are in the legs and crotch. Like, how is this a kill shot?
There's an artery down there. Yeah, I mean,
your femoral artery. It's the biggest artery in your body. If it gets nicked, yeah, you bleed out pretty fast.
But he falls over instantly dead. So
it's the shock.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never been shot, but I assume it's a fairly shocking thing.
I mean, unless it went like straight up through the crotch and like all the way through the body.
Yeah. Through the pelvis and all the way up.
Just doesn't seem like the deadly shot. In the lobby, Al has been looking around for a bit and is at the point where if he took a couple more steps, he would have been murdered by the backup bad guy hiding near the elevators. And he decides to say, to hell with this, and he leaves, and he calls it in as a false alarm, and as he's singing Let It Snow to himself and getting in his car, he has a dead body land on his windshield. How John was finally able to break that window is a mystery, but it's effective because Al starts freaking out and throws the car into reverse as some bad guys start shooting machine guns from a lower floor as well. He's screaming into the radio to send backup now, and ends up driving off a ledge, and we get one of the classic McClane-isms. Welcome to the party, pal!
I love it.
The scene cuts to a television news station where we meet slimy reporter Thornburg, who is played by William Atherton, who reprises the role in Die Hard 2. He's in Real Genius, Biodome, and Ghostbusters, where he fucks everything up as well by shutting down the containment unit in that movie, who is listening to a police scanner and he hears Al's panicky message. He tries to convince his producer to give him a van to go down to Nakatomi Plaza. And there's a bit of a funny exchange between Thornburg and the anchor Harvey Johnson. There's three Johnsons in this movie, I realized, who is about to go live on air. Harvey is played by David Ersin, whose IMDb profile pic is this movie. And of course, the other anchor at the desk is Gail Wallins, Mary Ellen Trainer, one of our show's favorites. This is her fourth appearance for Mary Ellen Trainer on our show. Mrs. Walsh, Monster Squad, Lethal Weapon. He threatens to steal a van anyway, so the producer reluctantly lets him go.
I found that the news team getting involved in this story was very odd. Like, I feel like their only purpose is really to show what's happening outside so that the bad guys have an idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strange.
But
yeah, they seem to be able to get into this, like, closed-off police area very easily as well.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the power of the press. I mean, but it's a very OJ-type moment here where...
Yeah. I guess, I understand, like, a news team would cover it, but the fact that they needed to have specifically show that aspect of the team coming together and going out
and the fact that the producer is like, what, this isn't a good story. It's like, yeah, it is. Like, the fact that it's Thornburg that is the smart one here is kind of mind-blowing because, like, he's a tool. Back to Nakatomi Plaza, where the police backup has arrived to set up a wide perimeter, Cokehead Ellis makes the comment that he never thought he'd be happy to hear the sounds of sirens. The majority of the bad guys are panicking about the cops arriving, but Hans is playing it cool, saying we stick to the plan when his radio goes off. And John, who has been searching the bodies of his victims to try to level up again, where he's now come in the possession of C4 and detonators, is calling Hans in an attempt to poke the bear a little. And once again, because we can't legally play a clip of this movie, and both Colin and Jack are friends of mine from the theater world, back by popular demand, we're going to do another edition of I Used to Like This One Piece Theater.
Let me pull this up.
Just like the last time we did this, Colin, Jack, I've sent both of you a script. So in this, Colin, we will have you playing Hans Gruber. Jack will have you playing John McClane. And for the one line, I get my own line this time. I'm going to be playing Franco.
All right, I'm gonna attempt a German accent.
Oh yeah, okay. It's all New York over here, baby.
And, okay. Hopefully, I can do a better job than Alan Rickman. All right, so gotta internalize my inner. All right, we're all ready? I told all of you I want radio silence until further.
V, I'm sorry, Hans. Nobody gave me the message. You should have put it on the bulletin board. Anyway, I thought you and Franco and Carl and the other boys might be lonely. Now that I waxed Tony and Marco and their buddy, so I invited some of the guys from my card game.
How does he know so much about?
Ah, how nice of you to call. I assume you are our mysterious party crasher, yeah? You are most troublesome for a security guard.
Sorry, Hans, wrong guess. Would you like to go for double jeopardy, where the stakes are double and the scores really change?
Check on all the Ajas. Don't use the radio. See if he's lying about Marco, and find out if anyone else is missing. Who are you, Jen?
Just a fly in the ointment, Hans. The monkey in the wrench. The pain in the ass.
Mr. Mystery Guest? Are you still there?
I wouldn't think of leaving, Hans. Unless you want to open the front door.
I'm afraid not. But you have me at a loss. You know my name. But who are you? Just another American who saw too many movies as a child? Another orphan of a bankrupt culture who thinks he's John Wayne? Rambo? Marshall Dillon?
Actually, I was always partial to the Roy Rogers. I really dug those sequined shirts.
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Yes! I used to like this One Piece Theater. I love hearing the different interpretations. like Jack's a very like salesman-y type New Yorker.
Yeah, it's not very good. My New Yorker says it's one tone.
I'm a wisecracking New Yorker. So now we get Al using his radio to call the person that radioed for help. John responds and starts giving a rundown of everything he's managed to learn so far, the few names, how many there are, the fact that they're mostly European judging by their suits, and dot 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 cigarettes. like how long is that? I don't understand that pause, but it's judging by their suits and
cigarettes.
He's also trying to tell Al in code that he's a cop with things like, I've seen enough fake IDs in my time. So we get a quick scene of Hans checking on the progress that Theo is making on the vault. He's through 3 of the 7 locks at this point, but the last lock is going to be impossible. But Hans, who obviously hasn't shared the entire plan with the team, is just patiently biding his time until the FBI show up. Well, not the FBI yet, but someone else does show up on the scene. Deputy Police Chief Dwayne T. Robinson, who is played by Paul Gleason, who was in Van Wilder, I Love Trouble, but probably best known as the principal in The Breakfast Club, a character he reprises in Not Another Teen Movie. You need conflict among the good guys to raise the stakes for this movie, and so we get this dummy. He comes in hot with who's talking to him. Al passes on the intel he's received. He may not be LAPD, but he's definitely a badge. But Robinson dismisses the information because he is far more skeptical about the validity, saying he could be one of the terrorists for all they know. Al has a hunch because of some of the things he's said, though, like being able to spot a phony ID, but Robinson isn't having any of that shit. He could be a fucking bartender for all we know. Something Bruce Willis actually did for a living at one point in his life. So cue the wink and the thumbs up to the camera. Back on the 30th floor, we get a Holly scene where she approaches Hans with a couple of requests. What idiot put you in charge? You did when you murdered my boss. She wants a couch for the pregnant lady. Don't worry, she's not due for a couple of weeks. That would have added a whole new level to this movie.
I had that thought too. Like, why would she tell him that she's not due for a few weeks? I bet you they could have gotten her out of there, like, with some information.
That's very true, yeah.
Right? Like, they probably don't want to have to deal with a baby. So they'd be like, okay, yeah, you go.
I mean, if it was a sitcom, that woman would go into labor.
Yeah.
She also tells him that unless he wants it to get messy, they should start taking people in shifts to the bathroom. And great negotiating, Holly. Fantastic.
I found it really odd that Hans gives her what she asked for.
Yeah.
Because he's been so cold towards everyone else. Mm-hmm. Like, he just kills Takagimoto?
Takagi.
Takagi? Man, that's racist. He just kills Takagi because Takagi basically says, like, you'll have to shoot me, and he just does it without any thought.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that in this scene, he's just like, well, I can't let you leave, or I can't let you go to, but we'll bring up a chair for you. Like, we want you to be comfortable hostages.
But he's kind of got his eye on the prize. So when he realizes that he's just wasting his time with Takagi, then it's like, boom, okay, yeah, fine, fuck you.
Yeah.
But with this, it's like, okay, this is the point where, well, we've got nothing to do but hurry up and wait. Like, we might as well at least be nice now.
Yeah.
For being an international bad guy, he seems fairly, like, a fairly good guy.
Yeah. Well, he's polite. He's well-mannered.
Mm-hmm.
Hans says that Mr. Takagi has picked his employees well, Mrs. Gennaro. Miss Gennaro. See? See, she could have said McLean. Miss McLean. But, I mean, you know, right, like, whatever. Holly ain't no slouch at this. Thornburg has shown up on the scene to start his reporting, and this is the point that Argyle, still chilling in the back of his limo, learns about the hostage situation on the TV he's watching. He turns on his CB radio, where he can hear the chatter from the bad guys. I guess Hans's wish for radio silence didn't stand. I also like that he automatically turns on his own CB to listen in, but you never see the cops think of doing this. Like they're questioning whether the intel is like true or not, and they never think of trying to tune into their CB channel. Argyle does it with no effort.
Yeah, like, and McLean is talking to Powell the whole time on the radio. Mm-hmm. So, and the bad guys are hearing all of that. So aren't the cops, isn't Powell also hearing everything the bad guys are saying on the same radio?
You would think. It was something that hit me on this viewing of this movie, where it's just kind of like, wait a minute.
Well, I mean, there's the chance, I guess, that McLean could have changed his signal to the police signal, but then all the police should be able to hear him.
Exactly. Yeah.
But then also he should be able to say, like, I have one of the bad guys' radios. Like, it was on this channel when I got it, so maybe you should turn your channel there.
Yeah.
And how many channels are on this radio? At least in Die Hard 2, the radios that they have there, you have to punch in a code. So, like,
I did find it funny watching this movie because it suffers from the same thing that most pre-2000 movies have, like the Seinfeld problem, where literally all the issues could be solved with a cell phone.
That's so true.
So, speaking of the cops, Robinson's plan is to move in a team and take the building by force, and they've set up floodlights to shine on the scene. John reacts by calling down to Al, saying it's a terrible idea, and we once again see that Al is the only competent cop down there. And if you are what I think you are, you know when to shut up and when to pray. Well, of course, the bad guys know the cops are coming because, you know, they've got cameras and obviously can listen to the radio. Theo is the eyes now, and to add a little levity to the action by reminding us it's Christmas, he says, 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring except for the four macho assholes coming in the rear in standard 2x2 formation. Like, he's got some of the worst lines. Or are they brilliant? Because they're so memorable. Oh, the quarterback is down!
Yeah, that's what he says. He gets blown up.
So the macho assholes are approaching the door, as inside the bad guys are taking their positions in the lobby. Notably here are the concession robbing Uli, played by Al Leong, who now has a hat trick with movies we've covered. He was in Bill and Ted's as Genghis Khan and Lethal Weapon being the other one. A couple floors up, we also see a couple of the bad guys swearing at each other in German as they scramble to set up the rocket launchers that we saw earlier. German is just such an aggressive sounding language. Like, maybe they weren't actually swearing, they were just speaking in German, so it sounded like they were swearing.
I do feel, I know one German word, and they use it quite a lot. It means go. It's schnell, and it just means go. And they use that a lot. Yeah. It's a lot of like, go, go, go. Well, and see, so I know, sounds very aggressive.
I know, was ist das? Das ist scheißen. What is this? This is shit. I now know how to spell Avedersen. So, as we discovered,
that's hard. Yeah, it's like the way you say it, like Avedersen, does not sound like how it's spelled.
Well, it came up a couple weeks ago in one of our episodes where I'm trying to sound it out, and Colin says, "Yeah, that's Avedersen," and I'm like, "Oh, like I realized that I've never seen that word written down."
Yeah, that's like with a lot. I remember when I went to Germany. There's a lot of things like when you hear them speak it, you can almost make it out because it sounds like off English.
Yeah,
but everything is written very strange. Like street is Strasse, and it's like Strasse or whatever.
Yeah,
so it's like mm-hmm. you're walking down the road and you're looking at the traffic signs, and everything is Strasse.
Yeah,
and stuff. And it's
weird. The funny thing is that Bruce Willis is actually more German than most of the Germans in this movie, especially Al Leong. So like I said, here come the macho assholes, and we see just how macho the one guy in the bushes is when he pricks his fingers on a thorn and says "ow" in a very non-macho way. They get to the doors, and the bad guys in the lobby shoot them in the legs to get them to back off. Now all hell breaks loose. Bad guys on higher floors, machine guns firing down towards the cops. Robinson thinks it's panic fire, but Al knows they're going for the lights, which Robinson realizes several seconds after Al, because Al is the only smart one down there. To add a sense of urgency to the whole scene, John is pacing back and forth on his floor, and Argyle is trying to escape the parkade. Uh-oh, it would appear the police have got themselves an RV! That was one of Theo's other terrible lines. And so it's rocket launcher time to use on the cop tank, and Hans tells them to hit it again, and John gets on the radio to tell Hans he has made his fucking point, so John decides to use some of his recently acquired C4 and puts it on a chair, adds some detonators, and then adds some more detonators, and then weighs it down with a computer monitor and pushes it into the elevator shaft. Chair bomb! Fucking boom! Bad guys on the lower floors are taken out somehow, but the lobby bad guys are unscathed. I'm no explosions experts, but I don't think this is how science works. It just doesn't add up that the guys on like the third or fourth floor are wiped out. But
I know that would be some intense timing.
Yeah,
like if he could time it just so that he knew when he dropped it, it would explode on the third floor and then take all those guys out.
And like nothing else, and it didn't, you know, break the structural integrity of the tower at all. Like, it was still fine.
Yeah, and I don't understand the point of adding more detonators, because it's like the explosive is the C4.
So how did they go off? That's my question, because he just dropped it. Like, those detonators need electrical signal.
Do they? Okay, they're not contact.
I don't think so. I mean, the ones that you see later are all wired up.
That's true.
So I went, like, you think maybe there's like a spark when the computer broke and that's what set it off, or like something like that.
I guess John is just
maybe
like,
maybe it's just like the fall,
but even yeah, then, the impact,
the impact, yeah,
yeah, impact, like, of the C4 or whatever.
I saw the Mythbusters playing with C4, and you can actually light C4 on fire and it doesn't explode. Does take one of these charges to set it off.
It needs like a smaller explosion to make a bigger explosion.
Yeah, I don't know. Huh. I mean, John must be like Bill Nye the Science Guy or something, because like he knows everything about everything. So Al is back on the radio talking about the explosion. Spotters say you took out two with that blast, and Robinson gets on the radio with John, but his attitude gets John to tell him to fuck off and put Al back on. You know, and then Al's all, "How you feeling, pal?" Pretty fucking unappreciated. Back on the 30th floor, Ellis takes a bump of coke and decides it's time to take matters into his own hands. He goes to negotiate with Hans, because he makes corporate deals every day. He makes a couple comments about camel jockeys and Hebes before saying, "Hans, booby, I'm your white knight," because he can give him John. John, who's talking with Al on the radio, Hans now interrupts his conversation. And he knows John's real name because Ellis is pretending to be the reason John was at the party, that they're old friends. Hans wants to know where his detonators are. Ellis thinks that he's made friends with Hans, and it plays up the "tell them or they'll kill me." And then John tells Hans that no, he just met Ellis for the first time tonight. He's a new friend, not an old friend. It doesn't matter. Ellis is toast. Hans holds the radio up so John can hear everyone scream. He'll kill someone else every, was it 10 minutes? Maybe every half hour, until his detonators are returned, and he gets the response of "Go fuck yourself, Hans." On the street, Robinson and Powell are arguing about the fact that John let someone get killed. While this is happening, Hans calls them with his fake demands, a helicopter, of course, and then a bunch of bullshit prisoner releases around the world. I do love when he gets to, like, Asian Dawn. Carl is like, Asian Dawn? Well, I read about them in Time magazine. So this is where we find out that, yes, they clearly are not terrorists. After the demands are called in, Hans decides to go check on the explosives up on the roof himself. And now the FBI arrives. We get the two Special Agent Johnsons, no relation. One of these, of course, is Robert Davi, who is one of the Fratellis in the Goonies. The suck-up Robinson is dismissed by them because it's now FBI jurisdiction. So we go back to Hans checking on the explosives when he bumps into John. And Hans pretends to be an escaped hostage. He tries to distract John long enough to get back to his gun that he put down for some reason. I don't understand why he put his gun down to climb up to check on the C4. John is all, no, come with me if you want to live. Hans is unintentionally thwarted. He's smoking and chatting with Hans, or as he introduces himself, Bill Clay, which McClane subtly glances at a conveniently located directory on the wall to verify. Like, smart cop move, but, like, why is this on the 30th floor by the elevator? And it shows, like, everyone on all the floors.
Yeah, also, like, yeah, you, I don't care who you are. You do not have the time to look at, to just glance at a directory and be like, okay, like, I don't know. Unless that's, like, a cop training thing, maybe.
It's to, like, go through words quickly and see which ones are important.
Yeah, like, he literally just glances at it and is able to see, oh, sees. I'm right there. Caesar in this general area. Well, got it.
And clearly Hans was able to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Because he even made up, because it's like, it says Clay WM. Yeah. So like, he even made up the fact that he's going by Bill, not William.
But you'd think that McClane would be able to look at him and be like as he's looking over and be like, oh, why are you looking at the directory? Like,
don't know your name. Oh, hey, a directory. This might come in handy. And
checks out.
That part got me. I like, look, glanced away when I missed the part when Hans, like, got up to that area when they first met. And so I come back and I see him with this English, this, like, American accent. And I was like, is that the bad guy? I couldn't tell. Like, I was like, what is going on? Who is this? And then all of a sudden it hit me. I was like, oh, yeah, no, that's the bad guy. That's Hans. He's just putting on an accent. But it took me way too long to figure that out. I was like, who is this random person that somehow got to the random floor? And then I was like, no, I'm an idiot. Not the movie.
What is this trickery?
Yeah.
He used to be German-ish.
Now he's American-ish.
Yeah, he's like American light. Like, even that accent, he's like, oh, God. Oh, my God. Don't you like it? So weird.
Well, and I even read something about that they decided to put that scene in, like, the way that it was, because Alan Rickman did a fantastic American accent, and it's like, well, he does a passable American accent, I suppose.
Yeah, it's American. It sounds American. That's about it.
So John decides to give quote-unquote Bill a gun, asking if he's ever shot one before. Well, that game where you shoot paint. And so he makes a show of cocking the gun for him. And as John starts to walk away, Bill / Hans says something German into the radio and aims the gun at McClane. I also read that the German that's used in the movie is not grammatically correct either. And especially with Hans's lines, apparently. So, well, Hans. Hans tries to shoot him. Click. Oops. No bullets. Think I'm stupid? Which, of course, is the cue for Hans's backup to show up. McClane dispatches some more bad guys, one of which dies with leg shots. And when he falls through, he gets shot in the legs and falls through a glass partition. So the legs really are that's the money in this movie.
Who needs knees, right? Not these guys.
Hans, who took note of McClane's bare feet, instructs Carl to shoot out the glass, and so Barefoot John is forced to run across broken glass to escape. He did, however, drop the bag of detonators, and Hans and Carl can now smile because they're back in business. They get back to the 30th floor. The pregnant secretary says that man looks really pissed, which Holly interprets as John's still alive because only he can make someone that angry. Speaking of John, he has dragged himself into a bathroom with his bloody feet. He's sitting on the counter, pulling glass out of his feet and chatting with Al on the radio. And this is the heavy drama scene for Al. We get Al's backstory of being a desk sergeant. Not quite sure why he was out in a cop car then, if he was a desk jockey. but it's because he shot a kid. He hasn't been able to bring himself to pull a gun since. Just lie low, the feds are in charge down here now. So
I thought that was interesting and like kind of crazy relevant for the time right now. Like, this was in 88, but, like, with all the like, police shootings and stuff, like, that's such a, it's such a common story. But it's, like, I wonder if it happened a lot back then, too, but just there wasn't the internet and everything to, like, bring it up.
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. So, the feds, yeah, they're in charge, and we see them wanting to get the power cut. And one of the power guys is insisting it can't be done from here, but the other one says, yeah, it can. The FBI's tell them to do it. So they cut the grid. I do like the hesitant phone call to, yeah, would you mind cutting the power on grid whatever?
12.
And I also love how when the emergency lights come on in John's bathroom, there's a voice that says, emergency lighting activated. Like, is this just in case you didn't understand why there were still lights in this scene once the power was cut? You just saw the power cut and, oh no, he has lights. We need to put in a voice explaining it to the audience. Or is this just like the computer, the high-tech features of Nakatomi Plaza? So Hans is excited by the turn of events, but we don't understand why. Why is he excited about this? The FBI are running their playbook step by step, and the Johnsons are laughing because the bad guys are probably pissing their pants right now. But au contraire, a power failure is just what they needed to get through the last lock on the vault. And so we get the triumphant Ode to Joy playing as the vault pops open and someone says Merry Christmas, and the Johnsons are just going to let them sweat it out for a bit, and then they're going to bring in the helicopters right up their ass, and then Big Johnson calls in for the choppers. And so in this conversation he radios in, this is Agent Johnson. No, the other one. What was the other end of that conversation? Like, hopefully it's like, oh, Joe? No, oh, no, the other one, right? Hopefully that's it, but, you know, considering the very distinct difference between the Johnsons that we've already seen and what our history of these 80s movies have shown in our show, that I expect something else on the other side of that conversation. So the bad guys clean out the vault. Now the overall plan, which all movie Hans has been playing close to the vest, is finally revealed in its entirety. When the helicopters touch down on the roof, they're going to blow the explosives, and by the time they're done sifting through the rubble, the bad guys will be on a beach earning 20%. And now we get John's heavy drama moment of what he wants Al to tell his wife if he doesn't make it through it. A speech that just goes on and on. Like, it's like one of those movies, it's like one of those death scenes where someone is like, oh, the lights are fading, I'm not quite gone yet, but like, it just goes on, like, tell her that I wasn't the best husband, and tell her that she was the best thing. And so at the end of it, he's like, do you got all that? And Al, who hasn't been writing it down, he's got it.
I was gonna say, it would have been hilarious if at the end, if there's a point where they think that John's dead, in an alternate cut of this movie, I guess, they think that John's dead, and it shows Al just like, yeah, I spoke to your husband before he died, and he just wanted to say... he loved me.
That's the Cole's Notes version, you know. Al tells him to hang in there and that the officers are betting on him. Oh, put me down for 10, I'm good for it, says John. But in this conversation, John suddenly has another Jimmy Neutron brain blast and wonders why Hans was up on the roof to begin with. He's going to go radio silent and investigate his hunch. And then we cut to Slimy Thornburg arriving at Holly's home because he wants to talk to the McLean kids. Paulina won't let him in until he threatens to call immigration. I'm wondering, like, is she actually an illegal? Because that doesn't seem like a very good idea to bring your cop husband into the home where you have an illegal immigrant. Like, John's already looked the other way of the cocaine that was under Ellis's nose because he's out of his jurisdiction, but come on.
It's strange, like, although this movie does, you have to give it props for the amount of diversity that it does have for an 80s movie.
Very much.
There are, like, strange scenes like this that are very, like, tropes of the time, like calling INS whenever you see a Hispanic person. And then there's also the scene where the Johnsons are in the helicopter and White Johnson is, like, he's like all excited with his machine gun out the window.
It's like fucking Saigon! Woo!
Yeah.
This maid is almost the one from Family Guy. No, no, Mrs. Holly not home. Yeah, no, but I totally agree with what you were saying about diversity, though, because it's like we've got good guy and bad guy Asians, good guy and bad guy black people, good guy and bad guy, well, okay, no, no bad guy women, but good guy, good, at least there's, you know, a couple of women in power in this movie. So we go back to John, who has found the copious amounts of C4. He calls Al to tell him it's a double cross, but gets interrupted halfway through his transmission by Carl with a gun to his head. And it's fistfight time for Carl and Bruce Willis's stunt double. If this movie shows one thing, is that without a gun, McClane isn't a very good fighter. Hand to hand, he's terrible. He kind of gets his ass kicked really easily. Like the guy that he killed in the first scene, like he got lucky and rolled down the stairs and was lucky he didn't break his own damn neck. In Holly's office, where Hans has set up his base of operations, the TV starts playing Thornburg's interview with the McClane children. This, for some reason, makes Hans flip the picture up that Holly had flipped down earlier. Thornburg fucked Holly because now Hans gets her. He fires his gun in the air to get everyone to start running to the roof, all except Mrs. McClane, who he now has successfully abducted. That's what this is about? You're just a common thief? I am an exceptional thief, Mrs. McClane. Back to John and Carl's fight in progress. John gets shot in the shoulder, but eventually manages to hang Carl with a chain. The hostages have all ended up on the roof waiting for the helicopters. The helicopters are keeping low because they're expecting transports, not gunships. And, yep, Big Johnson is really loving it. Yeah, the woo, this is like fucking Saigon. And Little Johnson's response of, I was three, dick.
He's holding, like, a sniper rifle. He's not holding like a rifle that you would be like using in that kind of a
like a mounted
like
no yeah. He's just like holding, it looks like, yeah, he's holding like a sniper rifle.
Well, that's what I mean, yeah, instead, yeah, of a mounted machine gun.
Yeah, yeah, not like, yeah, a like a machine gun on the side of the helicopter, and he's like, I'll take him out, and I'm like, okay, you're gonna get a shot with your single shot rifle from a helicopter?
Yeah, I've seen The Matrix. I know what those guns are supposed to look like in the side of it.
Yeah, you'd have helicopter. To be, you'd have to be like Hawkeye or something to make,
yeah, like
shot.
he's not gonna take him out, like.
Well, yeah, and you have to reload a sniper rifle. Like it's not a quick process, so if there's more than one bad guy on the roof.
Yeah, like, what are you going to do? Like, and anyway, they fire with, like, the actual helicopter's machine gun, which is a machine gun.
That's true, yeah.
And then after, he's like, I'll take him out, and he's holding this rifle, and I was very confused as to how he was going to take him out, hovering not very nicely in from that helicopter.
So up on the roof, John tells everyone to get off the roof. They aren't listening, so he starts firing his machine gun in the air to scatter them. And in a moment of terrible timing, he's firing it off as the FBI guys show up. And they think he's one of the bad guys and start shooting back. And McClane uses a fire hose tied around his waist as a rope to jump off the side of the building. When the bad guys see the hostages coming back down the stairs, Hans orders them to blow the roof. The roof blows as McClane jumps and he hits the end of his rope and swings his way through a window that he shoots out just as the reel of that the hose was on gives way, and the weight of which almost drags him out of the window in a tense moment of trying to untie the hose around his waist.
I thought that was a really sweet scene.
Yeah,
that was like one of the best action scenes I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
Caught in the path of the explosion, the helicopter crashes and explodes as well, and we get one of Robinson's best lines. Holy Christ, gonna need some more FBI guys, I guess. and then I think of him in Breakfast Club, where it's like, what's that? I'll give you one more week. No? Okay.
I get it. Yeah.
Down in the parkade, Argyle gets his time to shine when he sees the bad guy's ambulance magically pull out of the back of the Pacific Courier truck they arrived in, and he rams it with his limo before knocking out Theo in the driver's seat with a single very weak looking punch. Like, this is the worst punch ever, but it's like one hit and he's out, right?
They add that nice TV thwack too.
Yeah.
It's also like, I don't know, it's like a battle of the two like nerdy black kids.
Back to a very battered looking John McClane, who has a machine gun with no bullets and a handgun with only two rounds left. He sees a roll of Merry Christmas tape and has another Jimmy Neutron brain blast, and he screams, Hans! Like in a Streetcar Named Desire Stella or Rocky Adrian type moment. He's shirtless, he's limping, and he's holding the machine gun. You know, he says, hi, honey. And this is where John also finds out that this was all just a fucking robbery as well. Hans has his gun held on Holly. John is ordered to drop his weapon, and seeing no option, he drops his machine gun and starts laughing as a misdirection as he puts his hands behind his back, grabs the handgun he's taped to his back, bang, bang, takes out Hans's henchman and shoots Hans, who stumbles and pulls Holly with him and falls out the window. And there's a struggle by John to undo her watch, which Hans is holding onto, and Hans plummets to his death, where Robinson gets his second best line, "I hope that's not a hostage." And to get a look of authentic surprise, the stunt team decide to tell Alan Rickman that they would drop him on the count of three, but then dropped him on two. So that's really? that's why he looks extra stunned, because like he was expecting an extra second. Yeah. Holly and John share a passionate bloody kiss. I've never understood bloody kisses in movies. Like, gross.
That's one of the most like, disgusting kisses I've ever seen on screen, I think. It's just so sloppy and
yeah, it wasn't even a good kiss. Like
and like you saw how black his shirt became. That, like,
yeah, he's like
that's
sweaty.
Still gonna be all over his face. Like
yeah,
of course he was hanging out in the bathroom, so maybe he washed. Maybe he gave himself the whole the hobo wash down again.
Time. The horse bath.
The horse bath. Yeah. Down on the street, McClane finally gets to meet Al in person, and they hug, and John introduces Al to his wife, Holly Gennaro, which she corrects to McClane. We get the last-minute cliche bad guy pop-up of Carl, with Al to the rescue, shooting Carl dead, and he's gotten over his yips.
This was the one that I noticed. There was not a single fatal shot. Like, he hits him in the shoulder, I think, three times.
Yeah.
I didn't even really realize that.
Strangled and beaten. He's done. Yeah, doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, he hung there for how long? Because we see him still hanging there when everyone comes down the stairs. So it's like, how strong is this guy's neck?
Yeah.
Yeah, and when did he come to? Because he was knocked out hanging there too.
Yeah. Like... Then with people still on edge over that moment, Argyle comes crashing through the gate out of the parkade. But John, whoa, he's with me, is he? Because like now Al is trigger happy all of a sudden. So Thornburg comes over to interview the McLeans, but Holly isn't having it and punches him out for being an asshole. Argyle lets them into the limo, saying, "If this is your idea of Christmas, I gotta be here for New Year's." And cue Let It Snow and credits. The end. Die Hard.
Movies like this, I always find it really funny, just because it's like, what did the next day look like?
Yep.
You know, like, what was, like, how much paperwork? And I mean, you're not a real cop, and you just killed, like, six guys. Well, you're a cop, but not a cop
out
in
of your jurisdiction, yeah.
Yeah, at that point, yeah, how do you get tried? Who takes the blame for all this?
So, that is Die Hard. Now, Colin, Jack, on IMDb, it scored 8.2 out of 10. And it has a Metascore of 72. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 94% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 94%. Rotten Tomatoes loving the shit out of this movie. But I think we need words to go with those numbers first, Colin. Do you have any reviews for us?
I do. So, yeah, I mean, the Rotten Tomatoes score says it all. The reviews for this movie are absolutely glowing. I even actually looked at the Metacritic one, and it seems, from what I could tell, there was a lot of... I know Metacritic suffers a lot from bots wrecking the wrecking their review scores and that kind of stuff, and that was the general sense I got from Metacritic on this one. So Jay Carr with the Boston Globe says, "Die Hard is film's equivalent of a terrorist attack on your senses, but Willis's intensity and present push it into guilty pleasure territory."
Yep.
Richard Schickel with Time Magazine says, "In the first half of director John McTiernan's movie, Willis wears an undershirt. In the second half, he gets rid of it. And that's pretty much it for his performance." So a little harsh. And then finally I have Karen James with the New York Times says, "The scenes move with such relentless energy and smashing special effects extravagance that Die Hard turns out to be everything action genre fans and Bruce Willis's relieved investors might have hoped for."
Right on. So we've got, if we ignore the Metascore, everything's above 80%. So where, Jack, this is your first viewing of this movie. What did you think of Die Hard? Where does this fall for you?
I thought it was awesome. And yeah. I mean, I did watch it by myself. So I was a little worried I wasn't going to laugh at the things that everyone else laughed at. Because I, you know, when you watch it in a theater, when you watch it with people, they sort of guide you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I really enjoyed it. Like I was like elated at the very end when Powell shot that guy, because I was like, yes, he shot him. Oh my God, he did it. And I giggled at the Yippee-ki-yay motherfucker. And I understood that now. Some things that I was like, oh, okay, I get that. You know, it's like when you watch a movie and there's a meme from the movie and you're like, oh, that's the part where the meme was from.
Oh, that's where the thing happened. Oh,
yeah, I watched Lord of the Rings and that happened to me a few times.
That's awesome.
Oh, so you now understand all the one does not simply.
Yes, yeah, okay. I finally saw that scene.
You finally know who Sean Bean is. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, if I'm going to put it on a scale, I'm giving it like a 9 for me because it was fun. It was fun and I definitely would want to watch it again with other people. This is my uncle's favorite movie. He watches it every year at Christmas. Yeah. It's his like favorite movie of all time.
Good man, your uncle's my new favorite.
And so like now I want to watch it with him just to see him enjoy it as much as he does.
Yeah.
Right? Like and cuz I really liked it. I was a little I didn't think I wasn't going to like it, but I was skeptical because you always are when somebody's like everyone loves this movie. Right, and if you don't love it, then whoa, what are you, crazy?
I find that especially when it's older movies. Again, I grew up like around the time a lot of these movies came out, but I didn't actually start watching a lot of these like 80s and early 90s movies until I was well in my 20s. And so, movies today are like they're vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy is different, action is different. Like a lot of things, there's more. You're used to seeing like CGI and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so sometimes that I do find that when I go watch older movies, it's like even storytelling is different. Like sometimes there's just a lot more dialogue and a lot more plot and like build up and that kind of stuff.
Less time for explosions and stuff like that.
Yeah. So,
but when you do have the explosions, they're practical.
They're done well. Like everything looked good. Some of the camera angles were odd to me, but it's because I realized they were trying to hide stunt doubles.
Yeah.
And that makes sense, right? Yeah. Like, there can be less of hiding stunt doubles when you have CG to make the stunt double look much more like the actor, when they didn't have that.
Yeah, because now the stunt doubles that don't look right, they can just,
Yeah, like now,
generate a face.
Like now, you could literally remake Die Hard with young Bruce Willis, just completely CGI on a different actor's body.
Yeah,
yeah, like you could. It's crazy.
Absolutely. Oh, and Jack, if you do decide to watch Die Hard with your uncle, you could even come up to him and suggest Die Hard 2 because that is also a Christmas movie. So. Die Hard 1 and 2 are both Christmas.
They're both set at... Why are they both set at Christmas?
I don't know, but at least Die Hard 2 has snow, so it's...
Oh, okay, it's not as confusing.
So, Colin?
It's also not as good, from what I remember. what did I think of this? Like, I loved it. I feel like Die Hard will be... I've always kind of, like, laughed at people who are like, oh, it's, like, my favorite Christmas movie and that kind of stuff. Because, like, from what I remember watching it all those years ago, I was like, it's an action movie, sure. But I didn't really even remember that Christmas was a part of it. But watching it now, for whatever reason... And I think the first time I watched that, I thought it was good, but I didn't think it was special. But watching it this time, I actually legitimately feel like it's a special movie. Yeah. I think it's one of the best action movies ever made. It's just... I mean, the terrorist accents, whatever, that kind of bothered me. But I thought, I like John McClane a lot. I like the fast pace, one-liners, the comedy. It just toes a good line of that action comedy that I really enjoy. So
yeah, and with the exception of some of Ellis's off-color comments, there doesn't really seem to be anything that makes you really cringe.
Yeah, I thought it held up really well in that regard, too. Yeah. Even with the diversity compared to, like we've said, compared to other movies that we've watched. This of all the movies that we've watched so far, I think this one seems the most like a movie that could have been made today.
Yeah.
Aside from the cell phone thing again. But so, I would give this movie, like, I'd probably actually give it a 10 out of 10. I loved it. I think it's great.
Yeah, this is still up there. I was going to say, I easily... fall in line with Rotten Tomatoes. 94% easy.
Yeah.
I poke a whole lot more holes in it than ever before because, you know, doing this show now, I'm so used to poking holes in plot points and everything like that. But man, I still love it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I could even get behind that 10 out of 10. I mean, you know, you beat me to that. This one's still great.
It's also really weird seeing Bruce Willis with hair.
Yeah.
For probably the first 15 minutes of the movie, that's all I could think of. I was like, oh yeah, he had hair at one point.
Yeah, and even the last couple
Die Hards. No wonder I got him mixed up with Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
Yeah, even the last couple Die Hards where they decide to shave his head and go for regular Bruce Willis, I was kind of hoping that they would give him a hairpiece for that. Well, there we go. That's Die Hard, and that is our final Christmas show of 2020. A big thank you to our special guest for this week, Jack Bazook. Thanks for being with us, Jack.
I think we should have Jack back for Die Hard 2.
Die Hard 2? we'll make it a Christmas tradition, yeah. Showing Die Hard to Jack.
Thank you for having me.
No problem.
If you like that show, one thing you can do for us is tell your friends. Word of mouth is the lifeblood of a podcast. Or if you really want to help us out on the business end, go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't really matter what you say. You could say yippee-ki-yay, and then that's about all you can say because you can't swear in those reviews. But it's not important what it says. It's those 5 stars that just drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
And if you want to get in touch with us or see what we're up to, you can send us an email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com, all one word. You can also check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com, where you'll find links to all our podcasts as well as our social media. Social media will be the best place for you to find out what we're watching, find all the extra content that we talk about, all the YouTube links and that kind of stuff. And then just keep track of what we're doing so that you can come and join us.
And if telling your friends or giving us reviews or sharing our social media posts isn't enough for you, and you want to be a financial backer of the show, an executive producer, go to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne and become part of our Patreon community. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at our first movie of 2021. Thank God this year is over.
Said, but the pandemic is not.
No. Wear a mask. On I
used on I used to like this one.
I lost my flow there. Merry Christmas. Join us next week for another I Used to Like This One.